This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now settle in, because I have a story to tell. A story about a boy named Leo. Born in 1908 to working-class immigrants from England, his people came to America following their Mormon faith. And these Latter-day Saints pushed handcarts across the American West in search of better lives. And Leo's life was easier than that of his pioneer parents. He married Anne when they were both 18. Leo drove a Wonder Bread truck and eventually became a sales manager at Chrysler. And even though neither Leo nor Anne attended college, they bought a home and raised five children. All five of their kids did graduate from college. Four earned advanced degrees. None had a dollar of student loan debt. Now, Leo was my maternal grandfather. His fourth child is my mom. And his quintessential 20th century American dream story? Well, it no longer exists. Most American children today will not have higher wages or more wealth than their parents. An American family today, headed by a single earner without a college degree, would have a very hard time owning a home. And it's nearly impossible for a kid from a working class household like my mom to graduate from college without student loan debt. And let's be clear, today's student loan debt ain't your or my grandpa's student loan debt. In the last decade, student loan indebtedness has increased more than 107%, driven by rising college costs, dramatic cuts to state funding for higher ed, and the aggressive entry of private lenders into the student loan market. And student loan debt has ranging consequences on the U.S. economy as a whole. A 2019 Washington Post article noted that student loan debt impacts everything from marriage rates to the housing market to small business formation, which is why nearly 45 million Americans who collectively owe $1.7 trillion in student loan debt cheered on Friday when President Biden extended the pause on monthly payments and interest charges on federal student loans through the end of January 2022. But while Biden extended the repayment pause, he appears unwilling to budge on canceling anything more than $10,000 in student loan debt per borrower. Last month, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said that in order to cancel as much as $50,000 in student loans, Congress, not the president, would need to act. And Speaker Pelosi also appeared to argue that the policy was unfair to people whose children don't plan on going to college.
Suppose your family was not, your child just decided they want to, at this time, not want to go to college, but you're paying taxes to forgive somebody else's obligations, you may not be happy about that. But you know what? We want all of our kids to reach their fulfillment. To the extent that they want to go to college, we do not want them to be prohibited from doing that for financial reasons.
Speaker Pelosi has framed this issue as being about kids reaching their fulfillment, but it might be much bigger than that. Solving the student debt crisis may just be about fulfilling the promise of the American dream. For more, I'm joined now by Michael Arsenault, New York Times bestselling author, and his latest book is a collection of essays titled, I Don't Want to Die Poor. Thanks so much for being here, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, MHP.
And also with us is Louise Seamster, assistant professor of sociology and African American studies at the University of Iowa. Good to have you here as well.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Professor Seamster, I want to start. And I started by talking about my maternal grandfather, who was white, and I did that on purpose to sort of point to the like expansive nature of this problem. But your research shows that student debt is also a racial justice issue. Can you explain how?
Sure, absolutely. We got into this just trying to understand what had happened with wealth over the Great Recession, and what the major story that came out of looking at debt over this period was a steep rise in student debt, and especially for Black households. So what we've been finding in our most recent study is that white student debt doubled since 2000, and Black student debt by household has gone up fourfold. So it's already unmanageable for many, many white families, but it's actually a severe crisis for Black families. And at the same time, the number of Black households holding student debt has about doubled over that period as well. So we have more people holding much more debt. And at the same time, their wages have not increased accordingly. And so this has really changed the story of what student debt is. And we can't make the same assumptions that people still make about like what college does for you over your lifetime in terms of better earnings with this burden of student debt following you over a lifetime. And it's also much harder to pay down for Black families for reasons we can get into. But altogether, we are really concerned about what this means for Black wealth as a whole, especially since college is supposed to be the key to economic mobility, especially for Black folks. And it has for decades in the past century. But at this point, we're seeing that Black households with student debt actually have much less wealth than their white counterparts. So we're seeing this actually exacerbating racial inequality as far as student debt goes.
Michael, I feel like somewhere you are raising your hand almost in prayer as you hear this, because I know that what the professor is talking about here is in part your story.
I started kind of walking around like one of the old Price is Right models. I was just like, yeah, this is me. My experience has been, I graduated from Howard University. I mean, I've mentioned throughout the promotion of I Don't Want to Die Poor that the same week I became a New York Times bestselling author, I lost my health insurance because I couldn't handle not only the weight of the financial responsibility of my student loans, I was also grossly underpaid just by being Black and gay because my honor left. Unless it all ties together with Howard, I basically have up until very recently been paying well over $1,000 a month in student loans for over a decade, because my loans were private loans, which disproportionately impacts Black college graduates. I kind of liken it to like the same way they do the subprime mortgage crisis. They take advantage of like already inequities and just kind of go there. It just was an overwhelming experience. Having to pay that much money over a month has deprived me of so much. That's why I ended up writing a whole book about it. And the whole thing about I Don't Want to Die Poor, and I'll stop here. But in one of the essays that I wrote for the New York Times, that kind of jumpstarted this whole process where I just kind of finally opened up about the financial weight and how this really impacted every part of my life. I used an anecdote about basically how my family thought I was suicidal. But as I always told my mom, there's no way I would take my own life at this point because you would still be on the hook for my debt. If there's any one thing that I can describe with the kind of internal trauma that can be with that, it'd probably be that sentence.
And exactly that level of trauma, the idea of not only do I have to stay alive, not only do I have to keep working, right? But like that this is debt that could follow my beloved, right, beyond the grave for me. Professor, a recent study by the Pew Charitable Trust says that, you know, borrowers, are saying that if they had to restart their loan payments, say next month, right, if there hadn't been this extension of the pause in payments, would have had trouble doing so. Now, listening to Michael, that is not surprising to me. I mean, I'm paying student loans, but they're like $250 a month. They're nothing like the level of burden that we're talking about for so many student borrowers now. How are they ever going to, I mean, pause or no pause, how are people ever going to get out from under this?
They're increasingly not. And I don't think that all our data that we have necessarily captures what is happening to people. I've decided recently to start trusting the number of people who say, I borrowed this much, I've paid for 10 years, I now owe more than when I started, because it's actually a simple mathematical problem. The interest is set so high that people can't, even with these very burdensome payments every month, that they're not able to even dig themselves out from under the interest. And then,
Professor, I feel like I want you to stop right there and say it again, yeah, because again, I still think there are some people who don't get it, that people have been paying. And
right.
What?
Yes. Yeah. So, and this, I suspect this is especially true for Black families. So the federal government has looked at the problem of debt burden as a problem of repayment and worrying about students going into default, so not paying at all. And so they have made reforms so that you can get a new payment level set so that you're paying according to your salary. That means accepting that your overall loan amount is going to go up month after month for the most part, if you're paying less than the interest accumulates. You're supposed to, at the end of this, get debt forgiveness already if you're in this income derived payment program. But what we're seeing is this payment period is so long that you have to really trust the government that they're going to, you know, in 20 to 25 years, give you back the remainder. And we're not seeing that happen. And in fact, Persis U has, they FOIA'd the government and found that only 32 people have had their loan forgiven at the other end. And yet, you know, this is kind of a wild situation, because the more I learn, the more I realize we don't know, and that people are kind of just assuming all these programs work without the evidence that at the other end they're working. And so everybody's just saying, oh, well, this isn't a crisis because students can just all get into these income derived repayment programs and get their debt forgiven at the other end. But we're actually not seeing their debt get forgiven at the other end. And so I am really wary of any reforms that don't involve like significantly reducing these debt burdens, because we're not talking about people who are just like waltzing away from their debt and holding it forever. We're talking about people like Michael who are making significant payments month after month, and just the debt increases regardless. And like our federal student interest rate is still around, I think, 6%. I mean, not right now because of the pause, but like that's higher than a lot of consumer debt interest. Mm-hmm. It's certainly less than corporations have to pay for their debt.
Michael, do you experience these loans as predatory?
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, I felt that kind of immediately when I signed up for them. I mean, it's just honestly, you have to make certain choices. I wanted to go to certain types of schools, and I didn't think I could afford that. I didn't actually think I could afford Howard. I kind of explained in the book how that process happened. But ultimately, I wanted to pursue a specific career path. And even if I grew up poor and not with all that access, I had the opportunity to do it. And I don't think... The thing is, like, if people ask me, would you do it all again? And my kind of choice is, I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't do any of this. Like, I mean, people's paths can shift and there can be different types of success. But like, that was an access point that someone like me otherwise would never been able to have. They preyed upon me in that a lot of these terms I didn't understand and take advantage of. Like, I take responsibility for taking out the loans. I knew I'd be taking on debt. What I didn't realize was that ultimately, even with the private loans, that really did take so much of my life. But the government loans, I'll just say like this, in 12 years, at least 13, I've paid $100,000 off in my private debt. That was actually more so everything I took out altogether. But because of those government loans, they haven't moved. If anything, that debt is tripled. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate within the last year to pay off all but one of my private loans. But in total, ideally by the end of next year or after, I'm just going to cross my fingers and everything else about it. Ultimately, I would have paid about $160,000 at least on what was like a little bit under $100,000 of a loan. Mm-hmm. And that's in like about 15 years. And I'm a writer in this economy. So, I mean, there are a lot of different challenges, but ultimately, like, as the private lenders, just even now, only are people able to get out or even file bankruptcy. That was the thing I don't think a lot of people understand, because of a 2005 bankruptcy bill that actually Bushman passed, but Senator Biden then worked on. Only now are people even able to sue and successfully be able to discharge their debt. And I noticed when I started realizing, curiously, most of them are white. So you literally have to be able to afford legal representation to file bankruptcy to get discharged. I wouldn't have been able to do any of that. I just had to deal with it.
So, Louise, let me come to you, because Michael's talking here about multiple different aspects of this system. The private loan system, we haven't quite talked yet about the Parent Plus system, the federal loan system, this question about whether or not this portion of debt can even be discharged in bankruptcy. Can you talk just a little bit about the differences across those various forms?
Sure. I mean, one key thing to understand is that debt can shift over a person's whole life. So, you know, a student like Michael would make a decision or not necessarily understand the decision, because schools sometimes get incentivized to kind of be opaque about how this works. But, you know, a student will take out either federal or private loans or a combination if the federal loans are insufficient to cover it all. But they also have the opportunity when they graduate to try and refinance a public loan into the private market. And there's actually always been this confusing overlap between what's private and what's public. You know, the federal government used to just guarantee private student debt, which made an incentive for lenders because they were getting paid even more if students defaulted. But they also spun off entities like Navient and Sallie Mae, so that they, you know, they had this like weird public-private feel. And so, you know, you can start with a public debt that ends up private. You can not really understand the difference between consolidating your loans within the federal system or refinancing. And then there's the loan servicers, either way, who are getting, you know, paid a cut for managing your loan. In addition to the Parent Plus loans you mentioned, where parents can take out debt on behalf of their students, there's also Anne Helen Peterson has been writing recently about the Grad Plus system, which allows people to take even more debt out. And she's been saying that that represents what we call predatory inclusion as well, especially as the credential expectations rise since the Great Recession, where, you know, wages aren't going up. So if you're going to make enough money to live, especially to repay your loans, you might need to go back to school, which, you know, starts to sound a bit like a, I would say, a predatory system, like, oh, this didn't work for you, come back to school and do it all again and take out more debt.
Look, Michael, as I'm listening to Louise talk about this cycle, and I, you and I have had this conversation before, that I got pissed over the course of the past month because I'd been paying my student loans on time, relatively low, you know, payments for 20 years, had some, you know, tough times during the economic downturn of COVID, and Navient started calling me like I had murdered someone, like calling me day and night, just every moment. And you were the person I turned to because I was like, I know Michael understands these so-called loan servicers.
Yeah, when people, I write about how I've been harassed, how they speak to you, even like around Christmas. People, I mean, generally speaking, people look down on anyone they consider poor or beneath. It's a really ridiculous American attitude given the meaning economy, but I digress. But yes, they will harass you. They will berate you. People make you feel like you are the worst thing alive. And they really have free reign to harass you day and night, particularly if you have private loans. And I remember you did text me about that. And I was just like, I feel your pain. And also just I went back to my old Catholic ways and did the sign of a cross. And like, thank God they don't bother me anymore. I wouldn't wish that on anyone because it is true harassment.
And so, Louise, I'm wondering about that, like these experiences, and Michael saying, you know, people are constantly asking him, would you do it again? So I guess, you know, as a college professor, as someone who does believe in the value of higher ed, but also really worried, right? You're a college professor as well, really worried also about what the cost of a credential, and that language seems important to me, not just an education, but the cost of a credential is college worth it? Should families and young people still be taking out loans right now?
Okay. Yeah. It's complicated because where I tend to put my emphasis instead of like individual choices and a terrible mm-hmm. system of choices is thinking about how to change the system, because this is all completely, you know, human made and could be different. So what we've decided is that higher education has to come at this cost. Like my friend Danielle Purifoy has said, you know, we know that our society doesn't value higher education because they make you pay for it literally for the rest of your life. Like they're punishing you almost for getting an education. And I think that I see that with my students at both University of Tennessee and now Iowa, where I teach. Debt is not something that these students are experiencing once they graduate or leave college. They are experiencing it from the minute they get into college. It shapes all of their decisions. And they just, it's this marathon run at a sprint where they're taking too many classes. They can't focus. They're having severe mental health crises often because they're taking on too much. And when I tell them to stop, you know, to take a regular amount of classes, they say, I can't, because I need to try and graduate on time or graduate early. I cannot take on more debt. I've been cut off by my family. You know, there's a million stories, and they're working, you know, almost full time. They transferred from community college. So when people are imagining like what the college experience is like, you know, and they're thinking about Animal House, it does, you know, I'm sure there's still people doing that, but they're the people who didn't have to take on debt, I think. And so we've got this like dual track system where everybody else is just racing the clock to, you know, try and make it out. And that's not, so I think all this is completely fixable if we just restructured how higher education is paid for and made this public institution actually free to attend, as we do with K-12 public schools. Like, And so I think that I don't like to say what a family should do, because this is a really hard situation. And it's not like, oh, you should have simply made the better choice. Like, this is a national problem and not a problem of the people who made bad choices versus the ones who made good choices.
Louise Seamster is an assistant professor of sociology and African-American studies at the University of Iowa. And Michael Arsenault is the author of I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I Put My Faith in Beyonce, and his most recent book, I Don't Want to Die Poor. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The gender gap in higher education is nothing new, and it's grown more intense since the onset of the pandemic. Data show it's particularly pervasive for men of color. Kelly Field is a freelance journalist who's been covering education for 20 years. She recently wrote about this gender gap for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
We've been seeing women outnumber men in higher education for a number of years, and the gap has been growing steadily larger. But we saw an acceleration of that trend during the pandemic. The male undergraduate enrollment fell by 7%, which was nearly three times as much as female enrollment. And that decline was the steepest, and the gender gap was the largest among students of color who are attending community colleges.
Let's break down those two aspects. So men of color, and then also men in community colleges who are also tend to be men of color. But start with the men of color. Why the steepest declines there as opposed to with young white men?
Well, you know, it's partly because of the disproportionate impact that the pandemic had on communities of color. People were more likely to have lost their jobs or have become sick, and that influenced their decisions about enrolling in college. Either hesitancy about being in school during the pandemic, or feeling that they needed to work because a family member might have lost a job.
We know that men may have that higher earning potential, but isn't it also the case, and I guess this is part of what surprised me about the findings, that women often have sort of compounding domestic responsibilities? And it seems to me that in the context of the pandemic, I would have suspected that it was women who we were going to lose relative to college enrollment.
Yeah, I mean, you would have thought so. But I think the fact that a lot of colleges, or nearly all colleges, went online, actually, and a lot of women were staying home to help their kids with school, may have enabled them to do their own schoolwork alongside their children.
Right. Because now you weren't having to leave them and go to a place.
Right. Exactly.
Now, talk about community colleges. How is this different than 4 years?
Well, across the board, community colleges saw the steepest decline in enrollment. But as I mentioned before, it was steepest among Black and Hispanic men. Their enrollment plummeted by almost 20% for Black men and 16.6% for Hispanic men, which was about 10 percentage points more than the drops in Black and Hispanic female enrollment. And we saw smaller drops in enrollment of Asian men, but they were still about eight times the size of the drops for Asian women.
So here's what makes me nervous. I feel like I've been doing work as an intersectional Black feminist for years now to draw attention to the ways that, for example, Black girls and Black women have very specific vulnerabilities within systems, have been trying to kind of push and advocate for programs addressing girls and women. But these numbers are also very convincing about the fact that we probably also need some that are directly impacting men and men of color. How do we balance that?
Colleges have been creating programs for women for a number of years, but there's not nearly as many programs for men. And, in recent years, we've seen some growth in that area, but there's still, it can be a tough sell for colleges because of this perception that, men have a lot of advantages in our society. They tend to out-earn women, for example. And so convincing administrators to create these programs can be challenging. But there's roughly 100 programs, according to one estimate, for men on college campuses, which is, you know, far outnumbered by the number of programs for women. And the majority of these tend to be geared towards men of color.
And what does a program look like? I mean, what does it mean to say we have a program to try to attract or retain men on our campus?
Yeah, well, these programs offer different things. A lot of times they offer fellowship, you know, a sense of community for students who, you know, there's a lot of research that suggests that men of color often feel alienated from college, and that their sense of not belonging has been deepened by the pandemic and the racial unrest that we've experienced in this country. So to some degree, they focus on creating the sense of community and belonging. They often talk about sort of challenging conventional stereotypes about manhood. And then they often provide academic supports, financial supports, and sometimes as a case management approach of, you know, helping students work through the barriers that force them to drop out. It can be anything from, like, you know, a broken down car to a missed rent payment, that sort of thing.
I'm also wondering about the sort of non-higher ed aspects of this. So, you know, when you say, for example, that Black men have the steepest decline, you know, I'm wondering, for example, about the effects of incarceration, and not just sort of the effects of incarceration in that moment, but the fact that it remains true that you can't get federal student loans after certain kinds of incarcerations. So I'm wondering if there's also, like, broader policies outside of the higher ed landscape that need to happen in order to address what's going on in these classrooms.
Yeah. I mean, there needs to be, you know, policy changes in employment in terms of making it easier for men to get jobs once they're released from prison, if they get an education. There has been a lot of movement in making Pell Grants eligible to men in prison so that they can advance their education when they're incarcerated.
I'm wondering also about the cost of college in general. So is the numbers you were looking at are our enrollment numbers. I'm wondering if we also know something about retention and if part of what's going on here is, you know, that we may be losing men on the retention end as well.
Retention is a big issue. And, you know, in the context of the pandemic, there's not really a clear understanding of why men dropped out more. But some of it is believed to be because of this need to work during the pandemic. And some of it is also because the programs that tend to attract more men than women didn't necessarily translate well to online, especially at the community college level, you know, like really hands-on technical programs, just they didn't really work in an online environment.
Just so that we, you know, kind of lay this out, what difference does it make? I mean, if boys can't, you know, meet the same standards as girls in, you know, K-12 and we have fewer men on campus, who cares? Why does it matter?
Yeah, well, it matters a lot. I mean, it matters to the individuals who are going to lose out on a lot of lifetime earnings. I think the Social Security Administration said that men with college degrees make close to $1 million more in lifetime earnings than those without. It matters for the colleges who are going to have less revenue, and they're already seeing enrollment declines in many parts of the country due to changing demographics. And it means less viewpoint diversity for them as well. And then broadly for the economy, it's fewer workers to fill an increasing number of jobs that require at least some college education, if not a degree, like a certificate or, you know, a diploma of some kind.
In so many ways, I'm not surprised at the groups who were most impacted here. But there was one sort of counterintuitive, you know, hypothesis I had, which I thought, oh, maybe we will actually see a steeper decline among white men. And my counterintuitive hypothesis here was that we've heard a kind of significant pushback against higher ed from the conservative right, this sense that, you know, higher ed is this kind of ultra liberal space where people aren't learning real skills. They're just kind of sitting around, you know, twiddling their thumbs and being, you know, kind of policed in terms of their identities and their ideologies. And yet that doesn't seem to be, you know, who we're losing here in these classrooms. Is there any reason to think that the more conservative discourse about the irrelevance of higher ed is having any kind of impact?
For sure. I mean, I think across races, there's this continuing and growing question of, you know, is college worth it, you know? And then, and also the concerns that it's elitist or that it's, you know, training for the left. And we do see, and we have for a while, fewer fewer men from rural areas enrolling in college. And there's been a real effort to try to get more of them in. I think with community colleges, you know, those tend to be more vocationally oriented. So there's probably less of that perception that it's sort of a bastion of elitism or liberalism than there would be, you know, at some of the four-year colleges.
Absolutely. Kelly Field is a freelance journalist who's been covering education for 20 years. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was wonderful. Thank you.
A few numbers for you to consider. 2.7 million children. This is how many kids have an incarcerated parent. And in most circumstances, these children benefit tremendously from maintaining strong bonds with that parent. But $15 to $50 is how much a phone call can cost for just a brief chat to reconnect. The burden of this expense falls overwhelmingly on Black women, because 44% of Black women have a friend or loved one who is imprisoned. And all this is very big business, which is how the correctional telecom sector generates $1.4 billion annually. Now, the state of Connecticut has decided to do something about it. In June, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont signed legislation to make it the first state to provide free outgoing calls for state prisons and youth detention centers. The law will go into full effect on July 1, 2022. Joining me now to discuss this important move in the fight for criminal justice reform is Connecticut State Representative Josh Elliott, who was a key supporter of the legislation. Josh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Diane Lewis, who is the mom of a formerly incarcerated son and a member of Voices of Women of Color, a social justice organization based in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you for having me.
Josh, I want to start with you. What led to this set of decisions by the state of Connecticut to move towards a policy of reducing and then making free the cost of outgoing calls?
So Connecticut had actually considered this a number of times over the last couple of decades. I heard about three or four different times, but for whatever reason, it had never gained traction. And what I found during the few years of really pushing this legislation forward is that while people were generally accepting of the idea that these calls should be cheaper, not everybody agreed that they should be free, which was a priority of Diane's and myself and the advocates that were working on this bill. And then the other really difficult hurdle to overcome was the fact that there was a fiscal cost to this bill, and that there was about somewhere between $7 to $8 million worth of correctional officers' salaries that we would have to fill in. And that was very difficult for a lot of people to manage in terms of how we would fill in those holes.
Could also incarcerate fewer people.
So Connecticut has actually been doing a pretty good job of that. Under Malloy, we enacted some pretty strong second chance society policies. And so over the last decade or so, we've actually gone from a high watermark of around 18,000 or so incarcerated people down to around 9,000 or so. But the industry has stayed pretty strong. And when I say that, I mean that we have not closed nearly as many prisons as we should be, and we have nearly the same amount of correctional officers. So there's still a lot of executive work to be done to right-size our ship when it comes to the prison industrial complex.
That's such helpful context there, Josh. Hold for me one second, but I want to come to you, Diane. I started by talking about children of incarcerated parents, in part because I feel like they often don't get heard enough. But the other side of that is also parents of incarcerated children. I have a brother who's been incarcerated much of his adult life, and the expense of phone calls is something I think for those who don't have incarcerated family members, they just can't imagine what a size of your budget this is. Can you talk to us about what it costs to just talk to your son?
Yeah, the thing about it is that when we started this fight and we started to talk to legislators, I was totally amazed at how many legislators didn't even know that there was a cost to making these phone calls from prison. So for someone who lives paycheck to paycheck, it really crippled my household. I had to make the decision on paying for phone calls and eating lunch, paying a light bill, paying a gas bill, putting gas in the car. Everything came down to the telephone or this bill. And for me, there was never a question. I needed to speak to my son, who was 17 years old when he was first incarcerated, and I needed to speak to him every day. So the choice always was pay the phone bill.
Help people understand why it was important to talk to your 17-year-old son every day.
This was his first time being incarcerated. It was my first time experiencing having someone so close to me being incarcerated. But it was important for me for him to have constant contact with his family, because I believed that if we did this now, when he got out, it would be much easier for him to integrate back into society and, you know, become a member of our family again.
And have you found that to be true?
That is absolutely true. And I've seen the difference. I'm also a case manager for a reentry program, and I've been doing this for the past 15 years. And I can always tell when someone is coming home, had support, had family support, and those that didn't. The ones that had family support are more eager to learn, more eager to reintegrate back into society. It's easier for them because they had that contact and they know their families. They know everything that happened in the family, as opposed to someone coming home that had no family contact, no one to visit, no one to call. They're a little bit more, they don't trust as much. It's harder to get them to reintegrate back into society.
So Josh, as I'm listening to Diane speak, her testimony, her experience here, both as a parent and as a caseworker, is so powerful. I'm wondering if it was these kinds of first person stories that helped to sway legislators in Connecticut.
Without a question. What we found really worked for us in Connecticut was having this team decide strategically how we were going to push this bill forward. So the role that I played was very specific. I had the relationships inside the Capitol building in Hartford. I could connect Diane to people, although I will say that Diane certainly did a good job of that herself and didn't really need me too much. But there were advocates that we worked with from New York, Worth Rises and Bianca Tylik, whose organization was very instrumental in this. And I was able to connect her with a number of people as well, because it's people that are impacted personally that can make the argument far better than I ever could. I can ensure that people understand the process. I can ensure that those relationships are made and connections are built. But when it comes down to it, it is the emotional appeal that I think ultimately is what got this into law.
So Diane, I want to come back to you for a moment. It's my understanding that your son actually didn't realize the extent of the cost of these bills, and that it was only later that he learned of them.
Yes. And see, his job was to just come home basically the way I sent him in. That wasn't his job to worry about. Just like when he was home, it's not my children's job to worry about how I'm paying a bill or what bill needs to be paid. So we made a promise to each other. You do your time and you bring me home a high school diploma and I'll take care of the rest. And so he did that, and I did my part too. He didn't really know anything until, like, I got involved in this fight and the news media started to call me and ask me questions. And so that's how he found out.
And what was his reaction when he found out?
It was what I knew it would be. And I felt, you know, kind of sad at the same time, because I didn't want him to not call because it was too much. I needed him to stay on track. It was important that he kept in contact with all our family members, his grandmother, myself, his sisters. So, you know, there was a period of time where he was like, well, I just won't call. No, no, that's not what we're going to do here. You're going to keep calling and I'm going to keep figuring out a way to make it work. So, yeah, we had a little rough spot there, but we kept it going.
I so appreciate the realities of your parenting and the spirit of your parenting. And Josh, it feels to me like supporting parents like Diane, who are supporting incarcerated children, also supporting parents who are themselves incarcerated, who want to call and help with homework every night, right? So that their sons and daughters know that even in the context of imprisonment, they're still there, they still love them, they still care. What do the numbers, the statistics tell us that might back up some of what Diana's telling us about recidivism rates and that capacity to call home?
There's a lot of statistics out there, and I know the Vera Institute has done a bunch of research on this. And so we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if someone stays in contact with their family while they're incarcerated, they're significantly less likely to re-offend. And what was really important for me during my own journey through this process was shifting my thinking a bit. And so the goal is not necessarily just reducing recidivism. The goal really ought to be ensuring successful reentry and making sure that people who end up with their families again or end up outside of the prison system, I really should say, have a chance of securing a job and securing housing and being taken in by their family. And that's really hard to do if they don't maintain contact. And while that is what was the strongest argument for me, I had to find as many possible arguments as possible. And quite frankly, the emotional appeal didn't necessarily work for a lot of people. There is a significant cost to our criminal justice system. And I think it's something upwards of $50,000 a person is what the cost is to the state. So for some people, this was simply a matter of dollars and cents, that there's not just a moral cost and ethical cost as pertains to me and Diane, but there's an actual true fiscal cost that doesn't get us anything, because when it comes down to it, 95% of people who become incarcerated are going to end up being outside of the system, and we need to ensure that they just don't get recycled back through.
And what is the cost when folks are, when there are high recidivism rates, and maybe even, as you point out, beyond recidivism, what is the cost, again, if, for those who aren't like catching the emotional piece, but they want to know, well, wait a minute, in dollars and cents, someone has broken the law, they've offended, why should they get to talk on the phone every day? So what is the cost to the state of Connecticut, for example, if someone doesn't have that kind of successful reentry that includes housing, a job, and familial connections?
I think there's a significant cost, and what I have seen happen is as you're walking the halls of the Capitol, you'll get to thinking, how do I change this behavior? How do I ensure that this certain thing doesn't happen? And government, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, is a blunt instrument. And so for a lot of people that aren't well versed in criminology, just think, let's make this a crime, let's send somebody to prison. The problem is that a lot of what we see from our criminal justice system is not actually deterrent, so it actually does nothing there. We know our prison system is not necessarily all that rehabilitative, so people aren't coming out with additional skills necessarily. And what ends up happening is it just becomes a machine of punishment. And I think that if you talk to most people, they will not view the prison system purely through the lens of punishment, but that is what we've created. And I think it dehumanizes people. And I think it says that you ought to be judged by your worst action. And I don't think that is what a criminal justice system should do. I think we should have a system that is based more on a sense of rehabilitation, and we should be investing in people, not just, again, because of the fiscal cost, which is immense, but because of the moral cost to our society, that we should be, just as we invest in transportation, just as we invest in education, we should be investing in our people, and that includes even people who have broken a law.
Diane, I'm wondering for you, if you've seen, and you've mentioned this a bit here, but the other side, for sons and daughters whose families weren't able to maintain that daily contact by phone. I understand you sort of picked up another son during this process.
Yeah, I have a close friend, and her son also went to prison about maybe 4 years after my son, and she just couldn't afford it. And I respect her decision not to, not to juggle her bills and make a way. She did her best. But my son, after he had been in prison a few years, was like, Mom, just let's share some of the calls with him and let him call sometimes. And so that's what we did. So when he came home, and it was sad for me to watch, because she really is a very close friend of mine, and I have known her children before they were born. So it was just natural for me to try to help take care of him while he was incarcerated. When he came home, he came directly to me. I mean, it was just a natural thing for him to come and see me and, you know, talk to me. And on Mother's Day, and this is really sad, on Mother's Day, he called me and kind of forgot to call her. And that is the true testament of what being connected to someone who is at the lowest point probably in their whole life does. I mean, I was there for him at one of his lowest points. So it just really made sense to him that when Mother's Day comes, that he will call me.
Right. And yet I hear your sorrow and distress about the fact that dollars and cents kept another family apart in that way. I am so appreciative, Diane Lewis, of your work, of your parenting, of your advocacy. I'm so appreciative of you, Connecticut State Representative Josh Elliott, for joining us. Thank you both for joining The Takeaway today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And we always appreciate you tuning in. So make time to come on back tomorrow and do one more thing. You see, here on The Takeaway, we are always working to tell stories that you want to hear, that you need to hear. And because we're on the radio, we tell these stories with sound. Now, we want to know what your lives sound like. Right now, for example, I'm enjoying a few last days of summer during a beach vacation with my family. So this is how my life sounds. How does your life sound? Is it sirens in the morning? Is it a new baby at 3 a.m.? Is it dogs barking or tree toads croaking? So start making it a practice to take out your mobile phone or just an old-fashioned tape recorder and record some of the sounds of your life. Send those voice memos to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And very soon, we're going to start bringing your sound stories to life right here on The Takeaway. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Thanks so much for listening. Send us those sound stories. And I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway.